This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We want to pay respects to their elders past and present. Coming up on the show today, it's a grim picture of an escalating gun problem in PNG Highlands, calls for stronger food labelling regulations in Fiji, and will PNG's NRL team be ready for show day come 2028? More on that shortly. E o ngana egi, I said tapuako. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin in Papua New Guinea, and Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, says the country's brand new NRL team will be ready to take to the field on schedule in 2028. Speaking in Port Moresby at the formal announcement of the team's first board, Mr. Conroy said money for the project is flowing in and that construction of the sports village where the team will be housed will create 5,000 jobs. Leading the new board will be the former chair of the Canterbury Bulldogs NRL team, Ray Dibb, and among those joining him to run the club will be former Kumuls and Melbourne Storm star Marcus Bai. The announcements were made by Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape, who has called upon the new board as its first task to launch a nationwide competition to find a name for the PNG team. Now, our ABC's Papua New Guinea correspondent, Marion Farr, was at the media event. She joins us this morning now from Port Moresby. Let us say good morning, Marion.
Good morning, Aggie. Good to join you.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the speculation, though, in the Australian media has been that the PNG NRL franchise, you know, might not make it in time for 2028 launch, but Pat Conroy has dispelled that suggestion. So what did he have to say on the subject?
Well, that's right. There has been some talk that the PNG team may not be ready for 2028, and that's due to the logistical hurdles of setting up a team, a brand new team here in PNG, and a perception that the recent ARLC announcement about the Perth Bears joining in 2027 is a contingency plan for the ARLC should the PNG team not be ready. But both Minister Pat Conroy and ARLC Chair Peter Vlandis have denied those suggestions, and that was really, I think, one of the main intents of this trip to Papua New Guinea this week, was really to reassure people that things are on track. They're very confident that the team is going ahead in 2028 as planned. A board has now been appointed so they can get to work and start making some important decisions like choosing the team name and colours, appointing staff and coaches, building facilities, upgrading the stadium, all that sort of important stuff that needs to happen so the team can be ready to join the comp.
Well, I know Mr. Conroy talked about the legacy of the project, right? The Marape Albanese legacy, he called it. And I understand he made comparisons with the deal between Sumako Sumare and Go Whitlam that led to PNG's independence in 1975.
Look, there is a clause that does say that in our agreement, that it could be terminated if there's a termination of the security agreement. But our friends here, which are the best neighbours in the world, would never, ever do anything which would require us to terminate the agreement.
And let me just add, on behalf of the Australian government, that we are incredibly reassured by the statements from Prime Minister Marape that he's made in the Prime Minister's courtyard in Australia, in Canberra, as well as up here, that PNG is intent on partnering with its traditional security partners with Australia.
So what you heard there was Peter Vlandis and then later Pat Conroy just reiterating that the security agreement that was linked to this NRL deal will hold strong, and that there won't be any risk of Papua New Guinea sort of violating the clause that would mean that the club license may be terminated. So Minister Conroy and the Australian government are clearly very proud of this agreement. It's really one of their signature policy and development initiatives in the Pacific. They'll be spending over $600 million in funding to support the team and rugby league development more broadly in the Pacific. So it's not just sport we're talking about here. There is that security element, and it's something that the Australian government has been very proud of, and we could see that reflected yesterday.
Well, another one would be, of course, the economic development, right, is one of the reasons Australia has backed the PNG NRL bid. And if Mr. Conroy is right about the creation of 5,000 construction jobs, that would seem like a good start, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm sure that's something a lot of Papua New Guineans will prick their ears to hearing. You know, low employment rates and job opportunities are something that is a struggle here in Papua New Guinea. Now, Minister Conroy has said that those jobs will stem from various activities associated with this new team, such as upgrading the stadium, building a new centre of excellence and running the PNG NRL franchise. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people here putting up their hands and putting in their applications for those jobs.
Yeah, sure. And Marion, look, we know there are seven names on the new board to be chaired by Ray Dibb. But for rugby league followers in PNG, one name stands out, and that's Marcus Bai. What does this mean for the team?
Yeah, well, that will be another part of this announcement that's very pleasing to Papua New Guinean locals here. I mean, Marcus Bai is really something of a national hero and a household name, having really cemented PNG's name in Australian Rugby League when he played first for the Gold Coast Chargers and then more notably Melbourne Storm. And you can see how many Storm supporters there are here in PNG, and I think that's largely due to Marcus Bai. So people will be very pleased to have a strong rugby league representative on this board to ensure the decisions aren't just being made from a business perspective and that there's also, real sporting expertise here.
Yeah. What about the name, though, for the new team? You know, how will that process work now? Because I know Prime Minister Marape wants it to be the people's choice.
Yes, well, the Prime Minister gave a little bit more clarity about this yesterday. He said that there will be a competition to select the name. Now, it's not entirely clear how that will work, like whether there'll be a voting system to decide. I did hear on the sidelines some suggestions floating around about the name. Now, one of them being the PNG Angels, which is a reference, of course, to the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels who helped Australian soldiers on the Kokoda Track during World War II. So I guess that's a bit of a nod to the shared history between Australia and PNG. But whether that will resonate with Papua New Guinean NRL fans of today, we'll really have to wait and see. And there is a little bit of controversy these days around that term, Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels. So it'll be interesting to really see what other names come up and how the public decides what they want their team to be called.
Absolutely. Well, Marion, we know that Minister Pat Conroy, he's off to Solomon Islands this morning. What are we expecting him to do there?
So, yeah, this completes a week-long trip around the Pacific for the minister. His first stop was in Fiji for the Melanesian Spearhead Group meeting. He then came to PNG and now, yes, this morning, you're right, he's on to Solomon Islands. Now, his agenda there isn't completely clear. Reuters reported recently that Australia is preparing to announce almost $500 million in additional funding for aerial surveillance across the Pacific. Now, the minister didn't give official confirmation about this and whether that will be part of this stopover in Solomon Islands. But there's also concern in Canberra about China's growing police presence in countries including Solomon Islands and how those links could be exploited in a potential conflict. Now, I put that question to the minister. Here's what he had to say about that.
We've been very clear that we believe that China is seeking to have a permanent security presence in the Pacific. We've been very open with the Australian people about that. We believe that we're in an enduring contest to be the partner of choice in the Pacific, a contest with many nations, but China being one of them. And we, again, are faithfully implementing the 22 PIF communique, which said if there's a gap in Pacific security, go to other Pacific nations first and let them have the opportunity to fill that. And we're intent on doing that.
Well, that is definitely something that we'll be following up. But Marion, look, we always appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, Aggie. Good to join you.
Thank you. That is ABC correspondent Papua New Guinea, Marion Farr, on the line from Port Moresby.
multiple centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Now, staying in PNG, a United Nations-backed investigation in the Highlands has uncovered a state of lawlessness, which is escalating year on year as the number of illegal weapons in circulation grows. Salient, or the Saving Lives Initiative, is headed by former PNG Defence Force Commander, Major General Jerry Singarok, who says villagers involved in tribal fights who can't afford to buy guns are being armed by local leaders who can. General Singarok says in many cases those fights are politically motivated and can continue long after elections are over. Disturbingly, he and his team have established that the guns in circulation are sourced from inside PNG, from the police and the military. The General produced a similar report 20 years ago, but he says those findings have been ignored and the situation now is much worse.
It's escalated to now homemade and high-powered guns. We've also found that it's a thriving business for mercenaries. They call them Rambos here. They go from communities to go and pay back or murder, and you pay them. The rates are quite astronomical. And of course, the women and children and the defenseless suffer as a result. You can also trade marijuana for guns. That's quite common now because basically there's no government oversight in providing security or monitoring or deterring the flow of guns.
Do you have any idea where the guns are coming from?
From our interview, from reliable sources, and from the evidence that we've collected, all the guns seen now, from MAC-58 to M-16, AR-15, pump and action shotguns are all from the state, from the police or the military, or they get ammunition from the correctional services. There's absolutely no control, no oversight by the police or military or correctional services. We also found out that court exhibits are also now used to be traded or given to warring factions for money. So it's a serious concern.
You produced a similar report into this about 20 years ago. Comparing the two reports now, how much bigger is this issue?
2005, when we did the survey, I was the chairman. There were about 25,000 weapons that belonged to the security forces and about 50,000 illegal weapons in the hands of people not authorized to carry them. But I think the number is really short. I think just about 100,000 weapons are now out in the open. And these numbers need to be substantiated. But having said that, it's very difficult now to go into communities and do surveys because of security reasons. But most villages have an average of 20 firearms in every village in the Upper Highlands. And I think one of the biggest concerns by tribal groups and communities is that the government is unable to guarantee security for perpetrators and troublemakers. And that's why people have amassed weapons for their protection, not only for their family, but their communities. And one of the biggest findings is that many of the fights are election-related, meaning that after a series of national elections, people are left to themselves and still continue to fight between rival candidates. The other thing that we found out is that villages, ordinary people, are unable to purchase guns. I mean, we're talking about 20 to 30 to 50,000 kina. So we established that it was leaders, mainly politicians, businessmen and women, bureaucrats are supplying, they're buying these guns and arming their tribesmen. So it's a huge concern. It's a massive concern. And I've been saying since 2005 that the government cannot walk away from it.
I understand it's a concern that's also having flow-on effects because it's driving people out of the region.
Absolutely. And during our presentation, we had seven Highlands representatives coming and they all pointed to the cause. And they said one of the biggest causes is lack of leadership ownership of the gun issue. Our leaders are waiting to address this issue. And secondly, they've established that the security forces are directly responsible. And thirdly, there's a great flow of marijuana and drugs. And also we have a lot of people migrating or moving out of communities to find safer areas. And for example, Western Highlands Province, it's the middle of the Highlands region. It's wearing the brunt of all these spillovers, schools to hospitals and public utilities and illegal encroaching of land. I mean, there's so many social consequences out of illegal guns in the Upper Highlands.
So what will you be recommending the solution be?
The recommendations are based on what the Governor for Western Highlands, Honourable Wairarapa, said addressing the conference. He said he wanted political leaders to take ownership of this issue. He's advocating for a leadership summit amongst all the Highlands governors and politicians to address this issue. And we cannot do anything until the government has a plan on how to remove these guns, because it's beyond civil society. It's so cancerous, it's so big that we need government to intervene. I mean, we're talking about a gradual increase of guns by about 10 to 12% every year. Most people estimate that there are about 20 guns in each village, and you just multiply that by so many villages in the Highlands region. And we're talking only about the Upper Highlands, but the gun issue also goes down to the Lower Highlands. Around Eastern Highlands, Simbu and Juwaka, most of the tribal fights have been contained, but it's more on family disputes and conflicts and many times payback.
And that's former head of the Papua New Guinea Defence Force, Major General Jerry Sinarok, painting pretty much a very grim picture of the escalating gun problem in the PNG Highlands. He was talking to Carl Evans. Pacific Beat. Now, cuts by the Trump administration to the US aid budget earlier this year have had a flow-on effect in Australia, with some 120 projects losing out on $400 million. ACFID, or the Australian Council for International Development, conducted a survey during the first 3 months of this year to help them understand the impact on Australian NGOs, many of which run programs in the Pacific. But Lucy Cooper has been speaking to ACFID's Chief of Policy and Advocacy, Jessica McKenzie. Says a practical impact of the multi-million dollar cuts are actually far greater than the survey results would indicate.
Only 25% of our organisations in the ACFID membership, so we have 135 wonderful NGOs working, only 25% of them gave us their financial data. So that 400 million is from a quarter of our membership. So theoretically, you could expand that out. That is an incredibly conservative estimate. You could easily double it, I think.
When we're talking about this $400 million kind of funding cut, what does that look like? Is it having to stop programs, reduce staff numbers?
That $400 million has enormous impact. So 120 projects have been stopped. Over 20 country offices have closed, right? People are closing their doors. They're laying off staff. We know that just five organisations told us they had to lay off 500 local staff, not even from their organisation, but from projects that they were funding themselves. And if you imagine that five organisations had to terminate employment for 500 people, most of those people might have been the sole income for their household. So that's 500 families. So this is having a really big impact, but it's $400 million worth of projects around the world. Just one of those projects, for example, was in Yemen, reaching 765,000 people. It was providing food and medicine and fresh water to people who were really vulnerable in one of the longest humanitarian crises there is. And it was giving really critical malnutrition support to 26,000 children. So that's one of 120 projects.
For the Pacific region particularly, do we know how that $400 million, how much of that was cut from the Pacific region?
Yes, we do. So when we asked our NGOs to fill out this survey in the report that dropped last Monday, we found that the Pacific was actually the hardest hit region by these cuts. So across our membership, they reported $113 million of that $400 million is from the Pacific. So the Pacific is the worst hit in this regard.
Do we know what kind of programs, what kind of things are being run in this region?
We do. So in terms of the sectors that were most affected, the predominant sector affected was climate resilience and preparedness, then health, including things like the US was spending $8 million annually on HIV and AIDS. and then gender projects as well, including sexual and reproductive health. We know that there were all kinds of projects affected. There was a food security program in Nauru that's had to stop immediately. There was disaster risk reduction work preparing for earthquakes and all kinds of other natural disasters in Vanuatu. There were water and sanitation projects in Kiribati and Solomons that were closed. In Fiji, there was a drought recovery program that stopped. The list goes on.
How does these US aid cuts have a flow-on effect to Australian aid?
Sure. So beyond the $400 million, which, let's just be clear, is a really low estimate, and for $113 million for the Pacific, I think that would be a much higher figure in reality. Beyond those figures as well, there's two other ways that this plays out. The first is that the US was also the number one contributor to the World Bank and the second top contributor to the ADB, the Asian Development Bank. And those two organizations were spending $1.2 billion in the Pacific. So what our figures are not including is that $1.2 billion that was coming to the Pacific through the World Bank and ADB is going to be enormously impacted. So that's going to be restricted right back. A lot of projects are still coming down the line that are going to be cancelled from those. Secondarily, the US was working on a lot of projects in conjunction with DFAT and other donors, the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, who delivers Australia's aid program. Quite often, donors will put together funds into a joint donor fund and co-design and co-deliver a project. Let's say the US was providing 85% of the funds for a project on peace building or climate impacts. That 85% might have been matched by 15% by DFAT, or it might have even been 50-50. But as soon as that US funding is stripped, the whole project stops. So when the US stopped its funding flows, that means a whole lot of the DFAT projects have had to stop as well, and other donor projects. And I just wanted to acknowledge as well that even though the US announced this funding pause on the 20th of January, a month later we saw the UK also announce cuts to its aid program. And we've seen that matched by France and by Germany and many other European donors. In fact, the top 10 donors globally have all announced cuts or plans to cut their aid program. So this is actually happening across a whole lot of projects beyond the USAID projects. And experts like Robin Davies at the ANU have predicted that we're going to see cuts in the next 2 years alone, 2027, we're going to see global aid funding cut by 25 to 50%. So we're talking about a completely different reality in 2 years.
So from a domestic perspective, where do we stand now with the federal government's allocation and budgeted aid to regions like the Pacific?
So on budget night, we really welcome the fact that Australia is now spending $2.1 billion in 25-26. That's the highest ever in the Pacific. And what they did to respond to the US cuts was to reprofile a lot of existing funds and shift that to the Pacific. Given how much the US was funding on the health front, we were really pleased to see that Australia announced $81 million about a month ago for regional health resilience package. But what we're still asking for is to reach 1% of the federal expenditure for the aid program. So we're never going to meet the $80 billion gap that USAID has left. But what we can do is we can reach 1% of federal expenditure, which is what Australia was doing in 2005 to 2015. This has been a long-standing sort of figure for Australia, 1% of the federal budget. We're currently at 0.65% of federal expenditure. But also, we can, beyond reaching 1%, we can rebalance the program towards things that deliver core development outcomes. We can build on our regional connections, and Australia is really good with its development expertise. We have great health experts. We have great public financial management experts, all of whom have been providing technical assistance for a long time. We should lean into what we do well and make sure every dollar counts.
And that's Jessica McKenzie, Chief of Policy and Advocacy at the Australian Council for International Development. She was talking to Lucy Cooper.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBol. Well, the next time you look at a packet of your favourite prepackaged food, make sure you read the label, because there's growing concerns in Fiji of poor labelling practices. A recently launched Label Logic report recommends stronger regulations around food labelling. And so joining us this morning is the Consumer Council of Fiji CEO Seema Shandal to speak more about why these recommendations are necessary. That I say, Bula Seema, thank you for joining Pacific Beat.
Bulas, and you know, thank you for the opportunity for speaking today with ABC.
Yeah, thank you very much. Seema, look, when we are talking about food labelling, are we talking about expiry dates or wrong ingredients? Like, what exactly is the actual issue?
When we're talking about the food labeling, what we want to know is what is the ingredients, you know, if we are buying a product. I think it's the rights of consumers to know what actually they are consuming, what actually they are feeding, you know, their families. So what we have seen is that, you know, this conversation actually goes beyond consumer choice. It's about health. It's about dignity and transparency. And at Consumer Council of Fiji, we believe that every Fijian has the right to understand what's in the food they buy and to make informed decisions and what they feed, as I said, what they feed their families. So, you know, we recently conducted a research on the same, and our recently launched labeled Logic Report 2025 is one of the most comprehensive studies we have undertaken in Fiji. And it is also coming at a time when there's a, you know, Fiji is facing an escalating public health crisis. So, I mean, you know, it's everybody knows it. It's always on news that about over 80% of the debt in Fiji are now attributed to NCDs, which is non-communicable diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. And many of these conditions, we believe, are driven by unhealthy diet, especially the consumption of highly processed imported foods, foods that is high in content of sugar and salt. So we found that even if people want to make healthier choices, they are mostly disempowered by unclear and overly technical food labels. So, I mean, we want people, when they are out and about shopping, they should know what actually they are putting on the in their carts or in their trolleys. They need to understand what the ingredients are and, you know, what they would be consuming. So taking that into account, and, you know, as I have said that or alluded to that, the 80% of the deaths in Fiji is because of non-communicable disease. So we thought of just conducting a research and seeing what actually is driving people not, you know, moving towards healthier choices, or if they are willing to, what is stopping them? What are the challenges they are facing in terms of understanding the label or, you know, making a better choice?
Mm. Well, then, Seema, what are some of those products or packages or foods that you're saying aren't necessarily, you know, declaring or giving good descriptions of what is the ingredients in those foods?
So, I mean, almost all the products are outside, like the few products that we import from Australia and New Zealand, which has a health star rating and things like that. But there are so many other products because, you know, Fiji is heavily dependent on imports. And being a very small market, I know we are not able to influence, you know, the products that we import in. And, you know, I mean, there's a huge, big list. So, you know, just naming one, I mean, one from there is like, if you're consuming certain types of biscuits, right? So what are the benefits of consuming? What are the ingredients? Is it healthy to consume? Is it good for this family? Is it good for my kids? So these are some of the information that they need, but it's not available. And sometimes, you know, even if something is written on the packet, it's written in such small, small fonts that people are not even able to read it clearly with their naked eyes. So these are some of the, you know, issues that we have found. So that, I mean, if you look, as I said, if you look at different types of food products, I mean, so, you know, as I said, only very few products outside that is imported in Fiji has clear labels or star rating. But the rest or the majority of the food products lack it, lack the real information that people need.
Well, so then would that come down to, because I'm thinking I myself probably often don't read the labels too, but so do we need to be educated a little bit more? Because I understand you've gone out into the community to do that, right? How has that been received?
Yes, consumer education is very important because this is a new terminology for many as well, right? When we say front of pack labeling. So what do you mean by that? So what we do is, you know, Consumer Council is an advocacy organization and we are very aggressive in our awareness raising. So, and we always try to educate consumers, you know, in terms of you know, certain consumer education so that they can make informed decisions. So label, for example, labeling means nothing if people don't understand them. So what we do is we go out in different communities. We talk about food products. We talk about healthy food products and how they can go about making decisions. But at the same time, we know that the products itself do not provide this information. So whilst we go around educating, we are trying to educate because we believe, you know, consumer behavior can change change if the consumer mindset can change. And the consumer mindset behavior will only change if they have the right information or the right education. But then the education is useless if, you know, what we want, the information is not available. So you can see the linkage, right? So that's why, whilst we are doing a huge campaign or outreach program through radio, social media, community workshops in rural, semi-urban and urban areas, also, you know, school-based or, you know, through tertiary education. But for healthy habits to start early, we need labels that have full information, right information, and the information that people need to make the informed decisions.
So then moving forward, Seema, you know, what is the work that needs to be done to sort of see maybe government implement the, you know, better policies around this?
So if you look at, you know, why our current system shortfalls fall off this, because Fiji's labeling laws are set under Food Safety Act 2003 and Regulations 2009. That requires basic information on the back of food packaging. But several critical weaknesses exist, which is there is no mandatory declaration of added sugars, or there's no front of pack interactive labels like stars, warnings, so as I have already discussed. There's no requirement for unregulated marketing terms such is natural or fortified, and maybe the enforcement. So an audit cited in the report found that 35% of our packaged food items also breach at least one or two labeling requirements, like, you know, foreign labeling is not allowed, but we still see certain products on the shelf which has foreign labeling, which people don't even need and understand. So what we are pushing for is, because we have seen that, you know, it's, as we know, the front of pack labeling is not just a cosmetic change, it's a tool that can save lives. And we have seen that, you know, internationally it has worked. For example, you know, you can see Australia and New Zealand. There's a health star rating that encouraged product reformulation, where food manufacturers reduce sugar and salt to achieve better ratings. In Chile, after introducing warning labels, the sugary drink sale dropped by 24%, and sale of high sugar cereals declined by 37%. So, you know, pushing for this would be nice. So what we have recommended is, like, we are proposing a 10-point roadmap. I mean, I know we are somewhere very far away from it, but slowly I think we can achieve it. So we came up with a 10-point roadmap, with key steps, including we are proposing to develop a national front of pack labeling policy framework grounded in health equity, and maybe pilot a voluntary front of pack labeling scheme with local and international food suppliers. And then slowly, you know, we cannot just quickly implement everything, because it's going to distort the spell. As I said, Fiji is a very small, you know, there should be a transition to mandatory, but we can start with voluntary, because I mean, pushing for mandatory would mean that there will be huge costs, because we also understand the issues that traders will be facing or the manufacturers will face. So, you know, we know that slowly we can, from voluntary over the years moving forward, we can move towards mandatory front of pack labeling. And as I said, once we are doing campaigns, but we need to launch a national public education campaign to build the front of pack labeling. I mean, Consumer Council can do as much as it can. We are doing a lot of work around this in terms of advocacy, but we need a national education policy where people really understand right from the beginning what it means, how it can influence their decision, and the importance of it in making their decision in terms of food purchases. And also, you know, providing a technical and financial support to MSMEs to adapt to new requirements. And to ensure that this happens, we have to go back and amend the Food Safety Act to legally look at front of pack labeling and tighten controls on deceptive claims. So we feel these are some of the ways how we can ensure that we move towards, you know, front of pack labeling for Fijian market. And at the end of the day, if we have this implemented, that we need to have a strong enforcement capacity, including digital monitoring tools and so forth.
Well, thank you very much for that, Seema. We really appreciate just the very descriptive work that you guys are doing, and look, all the best for those 10-point roadmaps ahead. So again, Vina ka
vakalevu. Thank you, and Vina ka vakalevu.
And that is the Consumer Council of Fiji CEO Seema Shandell here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yes, it is Pacific Beat, but it's your, well, it's our time to head around the region to get the latest headlines. And of course, that's always brought to you by our producer, Carly Evans. Joining me in the studio this morning, it's Wednesday. How you doing?
It is, Aggie. I'm well, actually. I was actually just chatting with our audio tech in the studio about a Netflix documentary I watched last night called Poop Cruise, which I thought was relevant given we do a lot of work on cruise ships in this show. But yeah, this particular documentary is part of the new Trainwreck series. It really makes you rethink if cruising's a good idea. I can tell you that.
Well, there's a little plug if anyone wants to go and check that out. But thank you for that, Kyle. Hey, look, there's a couple of stories happening in the region. This one here, we hit Donga, because their health network has actually been thrown into chaos following a cyber hack. What's the latest?
Yeah, that's right. So hackers have locked the country's digital medical records and demanded a ransom, in short, Aggie. So government officials confirmed the attack yesterday with the health minister saying all patient files and prescriptions have been compromised. Here's what she had to say.
Could risk digitalization.
This is a risk of digitalization. What are we going to do after we recover from this to avoid being held hostage because of technology?
Yeah, so that was a quote by Dr. Anna Akaola, and it was Marion Kupo, our reporter there, who was translating that for us. The health minister went on to say that the attack happened on Sunday, and by Monday, a ransom demand had been made by the hackers. Australia has since deployed a rapid response cyber team to assist, and then in the meantime, health staff have been reduced to using pen and paper to do their work.
Wow, the good old pen and paper. But look, has this actually impacted patient health outcomes, though?
Well, that'll be the big question going forward. According to the most recent reports, the minister said staff were managing. However, the main problem has been the inability to access patient records as well as their medical history. So virtually everything from 2020 has been wiped. So the communication now between doctor and patient has become really key to keeping them safe. And the minister has advised anyone who needs care to make sure to bring their medical cards. So doctors have all the information or as much information as they can possibly have.
Okay, then. All right, let's head to our next story. People convicted of petty crimes in Fiji could be given a second chance following a new move by Cabinet. What's this about?
Yeah, so Fiji Cabinet, has approved to review a law that would remove convictions and criminal records on minor offences that are more than 10 years old. So what that means is anyone convicted of things like petty theft, small-scale property damage, curfew breaches, traffic offences, even driving under the influence, those convictions will be wiped from their records if they can prove that they've been properly rehabilitated. So this is reported by the Fiji Times. Unfortunately, the article doesn't state what constitutes someone who's properly rehabilitated. I think the devil will be very much in that detail. I can only assume it means that someone who hasn't had a repeat offence for a period of over 10 years.
I mean, do we even know why Cabinet has done this?
I believe it's aimed to improve employment and visa application outcomes, as well as helping to align with international standards. That's according to a statement by Cabinet. And by doing this, you reduce a lot of barriers, particularly for jobs, particularly people who want to work overseas. That's a big caveat for this. So therefore, the review will seek to have those old convictions made irrelevant for visa and employment screening.
Well, it's definitely a bit of a wait and see how that goes. Coffee. Who doesn't love coffee? Coffee is booming in PNG, though.
That's right. So international coffee prices have surged to unprecedented levels, and the latest figures paint a remarkable picture. So according to the Kina Bank, coffee prices jumped a staggering 70% in 2024, with an additional 18% increase in the first quarter of 2025. And this is mainly due to bad weather conditions in some of PNG's major rivals, so coffee-producing nations like Brazil and Vietnam. That's created a global supply supply deficit, which PNG farmers have been able to fill. So, yeah, that means more money in their pocket, improved living standards, and it's also had a great flow-on effect for many rural economies with, you know, farmers and people spending more money on retail and goods and services and things like that. So with a bit of luck, that should remain in place. The forecast at the moment has PNG's GDP to raise by almost 5% for the remainder of 2025, and that's going to be powered largely by coffee.
All right, I think we need one after this. But Kyle, thank you so much for bringing our news rep here on Pacific Beat. Now, the Australian city of Mackay, the Australian South Sea Islander flag, could soon become a permanent fixture outside council offices. It comes after the council agreed to permanently fly the flag, which pays tribute to people of South Sea's heritage, who now call Australia home. Local elder Marion Healy has spent decades trying to raise awareness of the history of South Sea Islanders and the challenges they continue to face.
Well, I say thank you to the council for actually acknowledging us now, physically saying that they will go about putting the flag pole in place for us. I think it's been a hard slug at trying to get it done. I remember last year when we raised the flag and the topic was raised by another colleague of yourself who had raised it with the mayor, and the mayor at that time said no, he wouldn't be going down that track. I thank Greg for going down that track and all his members there at council for considering it, especially when the Australian South Island people have been in Queensland for 162 years. And I look at Mackay's history. If John Mackay arrives in 1860 and we arrive in 1867 in the Mackay area, can you count how many years that is for us getting recognition by raising the flag for us? I'm amazed.
So, yeah. Marion, I think it would actually be the first council area, at least according to Mackay Regional Council, to raise an Australian South Sea Islander flag. So why is that kind of recognition so important to the community?
What it put in place for us is that we're a large number of Australian South Sea Islander people here in the Mackay area. We're the largest population outside the Pacific. Giving us recognition took that long for us to gain that recognition. It gives pride in the young people, the generation that's coming behind us. You know, I look at myself as a fourth generation Australian South Sea Islander. You know, we're getting fairer and fairer in the next generation. I want my grandchildren to be proud of what has been done by their great-great-grandfather in helping the sugar industry here in Queensland. I want them to remember then the long jobs of what our grandfather did, our fathers have done for us, and now ourselves as grandmothers and mothers. I think this is important that, you know, the hard slog of doing so much in this community, we finally get some recognition by this council by raising the flag.
In Wednesday's council meeting, it was agreed to in principle to raise this flag and to get this flag going. So now it's sort of on council to buy that and set that up. Could be a little bit of a wait, but it has been probably a lot longer than that for you trying to get this up. How hard has the community worked to try and change that?
I remember, if we're celebrating 162 years being in this country now, and when we did the anniversary for our 150, at that time I worked with council to get that flag raised back then. There was going to be no commitment by that time to have the flag to be continually raised here locally on those recognition dates. If the flag and the council takes a strong stand in saying, well, we'll raise this flag regularly with all the other members of this community, I'm extremely proud of them for doing that. I know that Bundaberg took that stand. I know that Rocky's having a look at their commitment to raising the Australian South Sea Island flag as well. Mackay, well done.
I suppose then, Marion, what would be the next steps for the community? Is there any other projects on the way that might be able to bring a bit more recognition to the work that was done and the historical work that's been done here in Mackay?
I really have to work really closely with community, not only with my community, but with communities that are taking up the stand on telling our story. I look at schools, I look at where I've been working with the Mackay-based hospital and getting all their staff in the know about the Australian South Sea Island people coming through their areas. I look at then where else are we making a difference, from government workers to private enterprise to tourism maybe, you know, telling our stories that local people coming into the area wanting to know the local story. My community needs to be at the ready to be able to tell our stories, and I think it's up to the next generation to be in the know about their history.
And that's South Seas Islander Elder Marion Healy speaking with ABC's Brian Wakefield. Now, 2 ton of books and educational material have been delivered to a Papua New Guinea school at Egan Barracks in Lae in what was a full circle moment for an army chaplain. Greg Roberts, a chaplain with the Australian Defence Force, travelled to PNG last week as part of an exercise cookbook to deliver donated goods from the Cowboys' local community and schools of Townsville in North Queensland. Chaplain Roberts told Lucy Cooper, as he spent his first years of schooling in PNG, it was a proud moment to address the school in Tok Pisin and give a blessing.
I actually had the opportunity to, when we present it, to present it to the school at their last day during a fellowship. So I was invited to come along to the school fellowship in the morning and present it as a part of that. One of the big things that really touched me is just how much the community and the schools in Townsville wanted to be able to connect. So they wanted to be able to give something which was theirs and to be able to pass that on to the schools. So we're talking about things such as microscopes, as well as learning materials, textbooks, library books. And so it was that idea of giving something of themselves to be able to help out those in PNG. And I think that's just in this sort of current culture where we become very egocentric, that's just a wonderful thing to see that we're actually looking out for each other. And we really value that connection.
You address the school essentially in Tok Pisin. Talk me through that. Were the kids expecting that?
No, they weren't. And it's always one of the highlights when I'm talking in one of the local churches or to the school in this case, is that I kind of keep it a little bit under wraps until I start talking to them in Tok Pisin or Solomon Pidgin when I was over there, and just watch their faces light up when they realise that I'm speaking their heart language.
I suppose it's almost a full circle moment, you know, with your previous experience in the Pacific, that you've been able to learn the language and then deliver it to a group of students.
It was also my connection with PNG, because I started preschool there at Ella Beach International Primary. And when I mentioned that at the beginning, one of the girls turned to one of my my colleagues there and said, Ella Beach, but my family's from Ella Beach. And she said, yes, he went to Ella Beach Primary. And she's like, no, that's my family. That's here in PNG. So, yeah, it was really an amazing moment that to have that connection. And, you know, almost half a decade later, be able to come back and give back to the place where I started my education.
What brought your family to PNG?
So my father was an engineer, and so in the early 80s, he went over there and he was doing road construction and planning roads in the country. And so I was over there. I actually have a brother who was born there, who now lives in Townsville. That was when I started school, just naturally as a part of the curriculum there.
How long were you there for?
I was there for about 3 years.
What a, I suppose, a unique experience.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think especially in those formative years, it's really shaped my sort of outlook on life and the way I approach things, because I've sort of had that, what we'd often call an islander sort of aspect to my upbringing. Whereas people were growing up, you know, riding bikes and the like, I was climbing trees and pulling coconuts down and, you know.
What does the role of a chaplain look like within the Australian Defence Force?
Okay, yeah. So the role of the chaplain within the Defence Force is providing care in a number of different capacities. So we're providing honour, we're providing hope, we're providing support. And I think that is goes beyond just the role of the military to fulfill a task. It's about the individual and what supports that individual to help them to be the best that they can be within that organisation.
How important is it to have almost like a religious figure or a religious aspect when defence conducts exercises in a place like the Pacific, which we know has quite a high percentage of its population who do engage with religion in any kind of form?
Yeah, I think it's vital, because I think there is the, again, that connection that goes beyond just culture and that understanding of that deeper held beliefs and values which a priest or an ordained minister can speak into and make that connection which goes beyond the sort of everyday textbook cultural learning.
And that's Army Chaplain Greg Roberts speaking with Lucy Cooper in Townsville.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, says the country's brand new NRL team will be ready to take to the field on schedule in 2028.
I think one of the main intents of this trip to Papua New Guinea this week was really to reassure people that things are on track.
And that's ABC's PNG reporter Marion Farr speaking there. We'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but tune in again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, Nija Daily with Sosifua Morley covering this the show for the boys while they're in Samoa. But until next time, stay tuned to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Politalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Politalk.
Search up Politalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.